Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Am I doing
great? Let's start with wins or progress notes. What are you up to?
Dave, am I the only one here?
Right now, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm still planning for the retreat, and it's this Saturday, so...
Yeah.
I'm doing okay. I'm getting a little nervous. I don't know why, but I am.
Well, that's a good excitement. That'll get you in a good focus for it.
Yeah. And I wanted to say that,
yes?
I really appreciate this whole new life story, because I see ourselves as taxed. You know, we're it's William Pienaar. He sees, like, we're all narratives. And
uh-huh.
I really love this idea that you're looking at coaching as, you know, a story, you know, like changing your story.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really enjoying this. I just wanted to say that.
Well, great.
Because it resonates so much with my own beliefs about the whole, you know, your whole perspective on life.
It seems like a really natural way to integrate so much of psychology, neuroscience, even quantum physics into the whole dynamics of constructing a story and the choice architecture that really lends itself to a coaching application. So I'm hoping it's useful as an organizer for you, because certainly the clients won't go through the experience that we do in training. Training is different than the coaching experience. So it's really more of an organizer for you rather than a sequence for them, but it's a way of listening and a way of co-constructing new experiences with them. So that's great. How ready are you for your workshop, your retreat this Saturday?
I'm ready. I have my copies. I have everything. I have. I'm ready.
Who is your audience?
I'm looking at. I'm not sure if you are familiar with the cultural iceberg.
Somewhat.
The iceberg is, you know, they use it for different things, but it's the cultural iceberg. So I'm going to look at, you know, one of the reasons for taking time out to get to know yourself is because 90% of who we are below the surface.
Exactly, yeah.
And we need to take that time away to reflect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I'm going to start it. And then the whole communication process as well.
Who is your audience?
My audience, actually, it's in a church. It's a church retreat.
Uh-huh.
So they've never had this before. They've never...
Oh, terrific, yeah.
Yeah, they've never been through journal writing workshop before.
Yeah.
So it's something new, but I just want to set the context, like, you know, the reasons why we need to, because we're so bombarded with noise, you know, in our
uh-huh.
lives. We really just look at the surface issues. You know, we don't really take the time to look deeper. So,
well, there's a great deal of neuroscience research that really validates what you're saying, that 90 to 95% of our operating systems are not conscious. So there's a whole lot, including the way we make decisions, that are really only evident after the fact. And after it finds something to light on consciously. So I think you have a great deal, and I can see some terrific application for a group like that, especially as it bridges into spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm excited. You know, it's a new beginning for me.
I've
been certified as a coach for a while, and I've done some.
Uh-huh.
I'm transitioning into it, like, full-time now. So
do you know how many people will be in your audience?
I just asked. They said about between 10 and 15 people in each session. There are 3 sessions.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Is it in Chicago?
It's in Deerfield.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Chicagoland. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, yeah. Exactly. Well, let's go. We'll be eager to hear how it goes.
I'm excited. I'll let you know.
Okay.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Okay, super. Has Amy or Shakuntala arrived?
I'm here. This is Amy.
Okay.
Amy, welcome. Bring us up to date. What are you up to?
Just working hard on my doctoral homework and trying to keep up with clients. But I'm excited to talk to you guys. I missed you last week.
Yeah, we missed you.
What I missed.
How's your dissertation work coming?
Oh, you know, I definitely need to talk to you about that. I'm excited to spend an hour focusing on that. I'm a little lost on my topic since I'm changing it now. But, you know, I'm excited that the coaching has influenced me so much that I even want to change the dissertation topic.
Uh-huh.
So that's exciting.
That's great,
That's great news.
Do you have a deadline with that?
No. I actually have 3 months. Leeway before I have to solidify it. Right now I'm still in the research class where we, you know, just constantly playing with the research questions and the purpose statements and such, but I have 3 months more before solidify it. So you and I have time.
You're balancing the doctoral work and coaching as well.
Yes, well, not officially coaching. I'm not a certified coach, but I obviously am doing the business consulting, but I'm excited to start doing more coaching and less consulting. I think this is much more effective.
Okay, well, super. Great. Has Shakuntala arrived? Not yet. I wanted to get, I want to schedule our times to do the write-up, the roadmap write-up, and wanted to suggest that we schedule November 10th, 17th, and 24th for the times that we that each of you present. First, are you okay with that time period, would you rather move it up or back? And secondly, may I have volunteers for those times if those times are okay for you? Do I hear anybody for November the 10th? That's about 3 weeks.
Actually,
Go ahead.
You will not believe this, but my family actually takes a 3 week vacation every November, and it lasts from November 8th to November 29th. So I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to pull away and log in with you guys on those three different Monday nights, because obviously I don't want to miss three Monday nights in a row, but I will be literally like walking away from them at Disney World or Beverly Hills Hotel, and I won't be able to give it my full, you know, I think you want us to present, you know, actually speak well, and so is there any way that I could have the week before that so that I could actually be in a quiet office doing my presentation and then just listening in on the others?
Okay, the week, would you rather do November 3rd or November 30th?
November 3rd would be wonderful. I could definitely get prepared by then.
Okay. Super.
Is that okay?
Absolutely okay. Thanks for volunteering.
Okay.
Olga, would you rather do the 10th or the 17th?
The 17th.
The 17th?
Yes.
Okay, I am going to put Shakuntala down for the 10th. Okay, great. And if you have any questions about it or if you'd like to have me look at it, I'll be happy to, but you have the example, and I think it's just a good application, a good way to go through it. Everyone who's done it has found it to be very useful. So I think it'll be a useful application for you. Now, challenges.
So basically, we'll just write it. I'm so sorry. Would we just write it up and then basically we'll be sort of reading through it on our presentation night?
That's one way to do it. However you would like to do it, and 750 to 1200 words, and maybe the presentation and our discussion of it for like 15 minutes.
Okay. Well,
so just the synopsis of what you put together, kind of like the example that I sent around.
Okay. Wonderful.
And that's either a client or ourselves, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And usually it'll be more helpful to focus on a specific story, a specific aspect, like a money story, a wellness story, but to narrow it down to a particular piece of work. But however you think it would. You know, you can best apply it.
Okay.
So, what about any challenges with clients or in your own work from the curriculum? Anything that would be helpful for us to talk about?
Before talking about a client, I'm actually curious about the wonderful workbooks that you were sending to us. I received an email verifying that you had sent it out, and then it never came. Have you received yours, Olga?
I did, and I just returned the money story today.
Okay. You have not received yours, Amy?
I haven't. I've been watching for it. It was over a week ago that I received the, maybe 2 weeks that I received the email that said it was
okay.
On its way. So I know you sent it, but
wow.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I requested my fulfillment house to send it, and they mistakenly, at least I thought for all three of you, sent the new money story workbook, and they corrected that and should have sent our workbook. So let me check with that.
I did receive
one. Okay, yeah.
And you have received the correct one, Olga?
Yes, I did. I received the new life story one.
Okay, you're right.
Life story.
I'll check on that, Amy. I'm glad you said something.
Okay, all right.
And I have the right the address I have is a 2633 McKinney Suite 130-520.
130-520. Yep, that's my office address, and they haven't brought me anything.
Okay,
it's a range of
suite on four different floors.
Right, but you have the right one, 130-520. You've got the right suite number. I can even do what I can.
Wait, say the suite.
Address.
Say the suite again.
130-520.
Okay.
Why don't I, right now, I'll email you my home address, and maybe that'll be easier.
Now, let me check, because they should have sent it to the right address, and that's fine. I'll just get them to double-check. There's no chance that it would go to the wrong place in the suite, because it looks like the suite is, like, over four floors. Could it have gotten lost internally?
No, I can't imagine. I mean, I've never had that happen before. I get piles of mail each day, so I can't imagine.
Okay.
That would happen. I mean, there's always a chance, of course, but in the 3 years...
I mean, is it truly a suite that's on four different floors?
No, that actually goes into the it's almost like the UPS store in the bottom of the building, and then they distribute it out through everyone. But no, it's never been a problem before. I just got a big stack today, in fact, when I got in from the weekend.
I'll check with my, if neither one got to you, something's going on. I'll check with my fulfillment house if you'll check with the distributor there.
Okay, sounds perfect.
Okay, yeah. I'm glad you said something. Okay, super. What else? Other things that would be helpful to discuss from the material or from your client work? We've gone through the first five steps, and we'll go through step six and seven today. Is this beginning to make sense to you and to develop a kind of understanding of the process of deconstructing a story? Any thoughts or reflections on that?
It's definitely making sense. I don't really have any questions at this time, but it's making great sense.
Okay. Okay. And what about you, Olga?
I believe it's making sense too. One of the things I really appreciate too about this is about the focusing on solutions versus the problem, and also the when it says that to stop doing something does not mean that people change, but that a new story means incorporating new behaviors and beliefs. That's key for me too. So there's a lot of different things that are treasures, you know, to keep in our toolbox. You know, I just hope I remember all this.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we have this notebook because it's here. You know, the binder.
Good. Good. Yeah.
I always refer back to it, and when
you know,
I keep calling it the toolbox,
it's there.
Go ahead, Amy.
I love that she said the toolbox. I keep referring to it as the toolbox. When I tell my husband or friends about it, I keep saying, this is amazing. This is such a great addition to my toolbox. I love that you said that, Olga.
You know, the idea of, you know, coming to the end of the past, really understanding things not being enough, comes from therapy. And when people stop in therapy, often, you know, resolving the old story doesn't mean that there's a new one in place.
Right.
You know, it's like taking the, you know, the software off of the computer, and when you do that, it doesn't have an operating system, so you have to really create a new one, and the best way to give up an old one is to replace it with a new one, because often the thing that we do in coaching or that people attempt to do and change is to add a new pattern onto the ones that already exist instead of disrupting the pattern that's there and then adding something new or something different. The most striking story about that is when I completed my residency in psychiatry, and I came to Baylor and was the associate director of the Baylor Psychiatry Clinic, and at the end of the day, one day, one of my residents came by to say, okay, I have a problem. I'm not sure what to do. I'm treating somebody who has been at home, you know, overly dependent on parents, and he's 33 years old, and I emphasize that he really needs to create autonomy and freedom, really needs to be on his own and to separate and to, you know, go out in the world and do his own thing. And, you know, and then he decided to do that. And he left home. You know, he got in his car, went to I-10, and then stopped at a payphone. This is a while ago. Stopped at a payphone. He said, okay, I left home. What do I do now? So we have to have a plan. Yeah, great point. Thank you. I appreciate that.
That's where coaching comes in.
Right. Coming to the end of the past is not enough.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you, David, and it applies to, I very much support the idea of sort of shutting down one story and just replacing it with a new one. I'm struggling to find the verbiage to explain that in a way that sounds healthy. Now, I have the binder, and I've been listening to you, and I recognize how healthy it is and what a great idea it is. But I found myself actually a couple of weeks ago out to dinner with a friend, and I was excited, and I was telling her, you know, what I was learning, and I was actually telling her that I was getting a lot more from coaching than from my PhD work. And I was explaining the replacing the story, and she looked at me a little puzzled, and she said, now, I should be fair. I think she actually goes to a therapist, and I think they spend a whole lot of time talking about her past and her childhood and such. So, it was a foreign concept to her, but she looked at me almost as if I was suggesting, like, repressing something and just shoving it aside and just making a brand new, fresh story. And I was struggling, obviously, to find the verbiage to say it properly. Can you tell me what that looks like? I mean, with everything that I know and that I've absorbed from your teachings and from the notebook, I know in my heart that it's a wonderful thing. I'm just struggling with how to say it properly.
Well, and that's a great question. One of the things that I think we have to recognize is that, and this may have been the case with your dinner buddy, whenever someone is experiencing something, they're not experiencing a story. They're not experiencing an old story or a new story or replacing something. That's the way things are. That's reality. Now, thinking about it in the metaphor of a story is for our organization and to find a way, if it's relevant, to communicate to them in terms of the choice architecture of this moment. But that's not the way they experience it. They do not experience an old story or a new story because they're just experiencing reality. That's the way things are. It's not a belief system. It's not a set of assumptions. It's just the way things are. So it won't be something that somebody's going to readily endorse in saying it that way. But, you know, one way to think about it, and this is just a conceptual one, not to explain it necessarily, but a way, and this is a way that I often began when I'm doing a training for a corporation to help them develop an internal mentoring program is to, and you've heard me say this before in our context, that whenever somebody knows something, has a fact, or has a belief, not only is that the way things are, but that also is an anatomical reality in their brain. You don't just present a better belief or a better way of looking at things or a new way of looking at things and expect that it's suddenly going to overwrite what's already there, because that anatomical reality, the groove of the neuronal networks and pathways, as well as the mind software that construct the story that support that wiring and that way of looking at things, those are all in place. But change does occur, and it occurs as a process. So we always have to begin with where someone is and look at other ways of looking at something, rather than looking at the past and how we got to be this way and the dynamics and understanding the meanings and the dynamics and the implications. We're looking at now and next and seeing what about this experience, this present story, but what about the experience and the choices can be improved. So we look at enhancing the things that work. And the things that work, we do more of them. The things that don't work, we do something else. So we're looking at now and next, looking at possibilities instead of problems in the past. So rather than understanding the dynamics, which means that we'll have a well-understood story, but it doesn't make for change because it doesn't light up the brain in a new way and looking at things that are challenges, that are stimulating, creating new pathways, to look at now and next, moving forward and looking at possibilities. That creates discomfort, but it also creates the excitement of exploration and co-creation. Now, does that bridge back to answering in some way or at least addressing your question, Amy?
It definitely does, and I think just the part, out of everything you just said, the part about the brain lighting up and how that's different, how it actually creates a different process. I think that is such a nice black and white, clear cut explanation for how it's completely different. I mean, anyone who's reasonable and is looking for why this is better than discussing childhood over and over again, that right there is just a nice systematic way of saying, this is why we do it. This is the proof. Here's the research. And this is why this is a better way to do it. I mean, despite the whole notebook with all the wonderful ideas, that right there is just concrete. It's solid. I like that so much.
Uh-huh.
I wrote that down.
Go ahead.
Isn't there a time where a person needs to be seeing a therapist, though?
For what?
If there is like an emotional issue or a psychological issue?
We deal with emotion and logic every time we meet with a client. So tell me something that
you wouldn't deal with in coaching. Coaching would take the place of counseling.
Well, tell me what would you need to see? And that's a great question. I'm just kind of tweaking it a little bit. What would you need to see that you would refer someone to an assessment for therapy instead of coaching?
Probably. Maybe issues like, well, that's bipolar. Well, that's like bipolar. If you see that there's an issue with, I don't know. Where there are mental issues.
Okay, tell me what you mean by that.
Hmm.
What would you see? What would you hear?
Okay, I would.
I'm giving you a tough time because I want to press your thinking about it, and I do want to discuss it because I think it's a great question.
And I know that when we were in coaching, they would tell us that just to make sure, you know, that to let people know up front that we were not therapists.
Okay, who said that?
Because in any I'm not gonna say.
Okay. No, I'll stop giving you a tough time now.
I just want to explore your thinking about it. I like that challenge. Wait, I want to make sure. Amy, hold on a minute.
All right.
Let's say you have a person who's talking. I want to say wildly. I'm not even sure because I haven't experienced it yet. But as you know, that there's an issue. I don't want to say cognitive, but it could be cognitive. Let's see. I would say, like, maybe hallucinating, you know, but while in your session. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. I think you ask a great question, and I think you're talking about a distinction that's important, and let me see if a way that I would conceptualize it would be of help to you. I think that any issues having to do with mind, brain, and body and creating a new story and understanding what someone is doing and looking at improving that can be in the domain of coaching. Now, here are the things that I would think of in terms of referring someone for an assessment. If the client has a story that takes over the author, and by that I mean, as you mentioned, a mental illness that has a biological component like bipolar issues, where the process of what they've engaged in has taken on a life of its own so that they cannot create a new story, such as drinking. There have been two people in 10 years now, a little over a decade, that I've been coaching of all my clients that I have referred for assessment. One, the first, is someone I referred to inpatient alcohol treatment. She had been, before working with me, an executive woman. She had been in a number of therapies, and a number of therapists had, you know, urged her to, you know, get some help in addition to what they were doing, but she had refused, saying she didn't have a problem. As we began to work and we began to look at regulating her state of mind, which was an issue for her, and she looked and saw what she was able to do and then acknowledged, recognized for the first time in her adult life, and she was well into her 40s and had really had a problem for more than two decades, really acknowledged that it was a problem and that she was not able, that she was helpless in the face of it. I said, then let's do this. Let's add this to what we're doing. And what I would recommend from what I've heard is an inpatient program where they have a total determination and support. And I recommended Sierra Tucson. And I recommended a couple of other places. But Sierra Tucson foremost, she went out there, decided to do it, and for the first time in her adult life, she's been free of alcohol. What she decided to do was to continue working with me even while she was there, because I kept very clear boundaries and did not step into or over that broad black line of coaching and therapy. And I think it's a broad black line, not just a thin gray line. And when she first presented, she, and this is kind of interesting, and I'll make it brief. They said, well, we don't allow contact with anyone, family or anyone, for the first 2.5 weeks. And she said, well, I would like to continue the time with my coach. And he said he would be flexible according to my schedule here, but I've been working with an executive coach, and I want to have that continuity and consistency. They said, we don't allow it. And she said, well, you have a choice. Do you want my $45,000 or will you let me have an hour of call a week? And they went back and said, I think we have a room for you that will let you do a private call. So she pushed and she got, and it worked very well. So there have been two people. Now there's also, and I mentioned this, I'm sure you are aware of it, there's a paper on my homepage, MentorPath, the bottom right, a white paper on the distinctions of therapy and coaching. That might be helpful just to kind of get an additional overview. Does that make sense to you, yeah. Olga?
Yes, it does. And I also say, because in the client information form, there also is a disclaimer saying, you know,
yes,
make sure that we're not therapists, that they understand.
And you're welcome to use that. I've had that vetted by a couple of attorneys, because it is a contract, and I think it is important if you have any kind of background in mental health in any way, that it's an important component to really specify what coaching is and what it isn't, and the various things. And you're welcome to plagiarize that the contract and the client intake as much as you'd like. Okay, great.
Where is that contract, the line that you guys are talking about, the one that you have vetted by the attorneys, where is that located?
On my website. The second tab from the left is coaching, and the second drop down is client information packet. And it's the next to last page.
Okay, wonderful. I have a question along these lines also, Olga, if you're done with your question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm wondering also, you know, obviously I'm getting a lot more excited about coaching than I am about this doctoral process. And of course, I'm going to finish the doctorate, but I feel like this is so much more authentic and so much more organic, and we have so much more freedom in how to choose or in choosing how to handle a client. For instance, I'm in an ethics class right now, and, you know, yesterday's assignment, ethical considerations in psychology, and it was a point-by-point reference to the American Psychological Association's, you know, ethics codes, and, you know, 2.05, how you handle this, 2.06, how you handle this, and I recognize why it's important, of course, to handle your clients ethically, but it seems so rigid and it seems almost not authentic the way in which you have to refer to every single one of these in order to give someone great advice that you think would help them and better their life substantially. And so when Olga said, you know, what if they need to go to a therapist, I immediately thought, well, gosh, there has to be something that I would refer. You know, what if someone was, you know, manically suicidal and I was afraid, you know, they were going to do it immediately. Wouldn't I send them to the emergency room, or what would I do? All of a sudden,
absolutely,
I was asking your question, my mind started racing as to what I would do. But short of immediate emergencies like that, you know, suicide obviously I think is a no-brainer. But other things like, you know, I even feel like we could handle hallucination, like if we talked to them for a bit. I mean, obviously if we recognized we couldn't, then we could refer out. But it seems like there are so many authentic ways that we can.
I want to interrupt you now, because
if there
is a storm in someone's brain and hallucinations indicate one of several possibilities, it could be organic, it could be functional, and you don't know and you can't diagnose, so that would be a definite referral. And the second thing
is... What is a list of referrals? What would you list? I mean, suicide, yes, hallucinating, and that was just off the cuff because I was just thinking about it when she said it, but what other things would you refer out automatically?
Well, any of the specific mental illnesses, if someone has not been evaluated or is not being followed by somebody. And the other thing that's important is to document the referral for your own protection, to keep a chart on each client and to document that you referred someone. Even if there's a contentious situation like a divorce and you're coaching one of the two of partners, document that if you referred that couple to coaches therapy, to couples therapy or couples coaching, document that so that the partner can't come back for alienation of affection. So whatever intervention you've made that may have some consequence, document it, and that's your protection. If it didn't happen, if it's not documented, it didn't happen.
Okay, so even if we don't refer out, even if we just, you know, coach them, that probably all needs to be securely documented.
What do you mean
well?
By coach them instead of refer them out for what?
If it was just a personal problem, for instance, in my situation, I meet with a CEO, I develop business strategies, I look for problems in his business. We get everything back on track, and yet he's still completely unhappy. And he and I speak, and we recognize that it's probably more of a work and personal life imbalance. And so then we start talking about what he could do. Of course, that oftentimes leads into, you know, how much time are you spending with your wife? You know, you get 10 of your child's soccer games in a row. That might be why, you know, you're so frustrated at work, because you realize, you know what I mean. But in the course of conversation, you get into their personal lives. Do we need to be extremely careful about documenting any advice that we give, you know, that says, you know, if I were to coach and say, well, you know, maybe you shouldn't feel so guilty about this, but you might want to focus more on this.
I think broadly the answer is no, but you're not going to be giving advice like that, because you're not going to be giving life advice. Now, there are a number of things that we do as coaches, in addition to asking powerful questions. Sometimes we give information, we story bust, we regulate states of mind, sometimes we advise. But it's not life-altering advice, and we elicit it from the client. The point of reference is always the client. So I don't think you're going to be doing things like that. You wouldn't have to worry about documenting that. There's some wind noise. If somebody's on a cell phone, if you're not talking, would you mute? Let's be continued here, because I want to be sure we get into step 6 and 7. Is that sufficient for right now, Amy? That we can then return to that question later if there's still some aspects.
Yes, I'm still super confused about not giving advice, but we can talk about that later. I definitely, you can go ahead and do what you need to do.
I give advice all the time.
Oh, okay.
That's why I call myself a mentor coach.
Okay.
Because I do a lot more than just ask powerful questions. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I thought you were just now saying, and you won't be giving them any type of advice about their personal life, because I was thinking that I definitely would be.
Oh, no, we do all the time. We give business and personal advice, but they're not hiring us as a consultant. We're not a content expert. You know, the advice that I give is to fully develop one's own story with an internal point of reference based on needs, ideals, strategies, goals, all of that. So that we're helping them develop their story, not ghostwriting it or running in plays. So it's not really about advice. It's more of how to fully develop their own story.
Make sense? Okay, I'll ask you more about that later when we have time. Yeah.
We'll come back to that then. Sounds like an important part. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so let's talk about the last two steps today. And just in kind of a brief recap, we trust our stories. They're our reality. When our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. So we change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we change how we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll probably live out this assumption. And we're always monitoring our impact as mentor coaches, what does and doesn't work, how to dose, time, and titrate our responses, how to incorporate the client's work and performance style and personality into the work, to not respond personally to the client's stuckness or resistance. So as we guide clients to offer new experiences, at first the idea of change for the client will create excitement. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, anxiety. Then, expansion. And then, finally, mastery. So, I want to emphasize two additional aspects that can appear together, but may seem a kind of paradox. And I want to view them from a wide-angle lens. They're really a developmental overview of writing a new story. So, they're not going to appear just per se and vividly. One. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. This is a process, developmental step, not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend, give up a habit or a pattern of behavior, or even a hope that by just getting this story right, by doing it better, is going to make it work. No matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. And again, the client is not experiencing it as the old story. This is our language. For example, every one of the hundreds of young women with bulimia I've worked with in the early and middle 80s, when it was a new phenomenon, most people didn't know about it, each young woman had to mourn her bulimia, the loyal companion it had become. It was there when no one else was. She had to mourn that, to give that up as a companion, a kind of metaphor of her story, in order to come to the end of her past, to come to her own identity, rather than being a bulimic or a bulimic in remission. it was becoming more of whom she really was. But she had to say goodbye to the old friend, the one thing in her life that was reliable that could calm her at times. She had to say goodbye to that. Secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. This carefully constructed old story, even with some aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. So it's kind of a narcissistic injury, because the very best that you could do at something, you now found out there's something better. So I see at least six components in this dynamic of change. Now, again, these aren't headlines. You won't see a manifestation of each of these. They're going to be easily recognizable, but these are just to think about as internal conceptual markers for us as coach. The myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. Nature of these are in your outline. The disappointment that nothing is perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. The development, the recognition that nobody's going to take care of it for you. That's often called adulthood, if it's approached in a serious and healthy way. The growth, to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation, the happy-sad experience that results. Happy about the autonomy of moving ahead, the effectiveness and mastery, and especially of not constructing an obstacle, and sad about mourning the old story. Even when you're happy to see it's gone, you're still sad about mourning it because that was a part of your identity. Now, to author new experiences, sometimes you have to think outside the box. We keep hearing that, but how do you do that? What does that even mean? What is the box, and how do you think outside it? Randall Kennedy put it very simply, thinking that frees itself of reflexive obedience to familiar signals. This is one of the quotes I saw that was written on the student union wall at Princeton. How do you know when you're in the box to get out of it, to revise your story or write another one? Now, these questions assume the story is there, like it's a given in the universe, as if the story, the proverbial box of the familiar and accepted, is the obstacle. But it's not there until you create it or accept it. And people are always free to change their minds, their beliefs, their core assumptions. The box, then, is the result of programming and conditioning. It's self-created in adulthood. And boxes are not a bad thing. They don't have to be limiting. They can be defining, and boxes is kind of a metaphor for a storyline. They can be guiding, validating, and expandable. For example, listen to a couple of these different boxes to hear how very arbitrary and very situational each one is, each with its own intrinsic set of beliefs, behaviors, and rules. The first, people treat a piece of processed leather as if it were sacred. They protect it, hide it, try to steal it. There are all kinds of rules about what you can and can't do with it, even who can touch it and who can hold it. If it crosses an arbitrary line somebody draws, it can count for different points, +2, -2, 3, sometimes 6. Football. Another. It moves in and out of your life. It varies daily. You want more but may keep doing the very same thing not to get it. Two people can do exactly the same thing and obtain really different quantities of it. You can buy it or sell it, but the price changes daily, even moment to moment. It's a stand-in for what you want, even for what you despise. And here's the lifeline clue. It's the most desired legal substance to all peoples of the world. Money. And a final one. There's no clear definition of winning. It's always at risk. There's always a price to pay. There's always another level of success. Money, your life story, your wellness story, any storyline you write. Now, and here's a footnote for those of you who work with executives or owners to write the next chapter of their business story. The box can be limiting or inflexible. The canal boat companies of the 1700s did not become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, at that time, Nokia asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world class. Good to great. So, open yourself to possibilities you haven't quite imagined yet. Scarcity is a rigid box. Abundance is expandable. No one can grant you freedom. You have to declare it. No one gives you power. You have to generate it, claim it, and not give it away. To recognize yourself as the author, the creator of your story, challenges an assumed model that leads to the deeper question, how do I create something else instead? And what will that something else be? So as we were just talking, to simply stop doing something is not complete change. A new story means incorporating new behaviors and beliefs. You have to embody, actually live your new story. To abstain from an old story, from stuckness or repetition, is a beginning, though. But someone has to engage a new story before you can totally give up an old story. A mind that accepts a new idea generates a new dimension. The brain that creates a new experience alters its neurochemistry and neuronal pathways. Neuroscientists now know that the brain is sculpted by changes and experiences. The mind can change the brain. It's an inside job. So I want to review with you a dozen AAA principles of change to author a new story for this step of authoring a new story. The AAA principles, the three A's, awareness, acceptance, and action. One, you're writing your own story. Is it working? For each component, what are the results? Honestly and simply assess each of these storylines with the question, is it working? And make that a yes or no. Your personal wellness story, mind, body, and spirit. Your business career story. Your relationship story. Your money story. When I ask people what they most look forward to, what they're most afraid of in the next chapters of their lives, they often respond with vague dreams, yet specific fears. The top of the list of long-term concerns, health and money. A not-so-secret to success is that you have to pay in full for that success. So you might as well find out what the price is. Pay it in full, pay it as soon as possible, and then enjoy the benefits of success. The price is always some form of energy, whether that energy is money, time, work, or experience. If you get something for which you haven't provided value or benefit, you still have to pay in some way. Now, an example. If you incur debt in order to purchase something before you've earned the money, you simply end up paying more for it. Another non-secret. People who truly enjoy getting what they want are those who can find a way to enjoy paying the price. This makes it easy to pay. The price is whatever you need to give in order to generate exactly what you want. Two, you're writing your own story. It takes just as much energy to create any belief in your story. Positive or negative, past, present, future, adaptive or maladaptive, the same energy for any belief. The belief of scarcity takes just as much energy as abundance. You generate the energy and give power to your story. Now, here's the subtle but crucial distinction. You give specific power to your story, and it assumes a momentum then and power of its own. And remember that you're not the subject of that process. You're the creator of it. So here's a short list of some results. If you focus on what you don't want, fear, anxiety, anger, confusion, annoyance, stuckness, helplessness, guilt. Three, you're writing your own story. Decide what you want. The primary reason people don't get what they want is they're not quite sure exactly what they want. Here's a neuroscience law of attraction question. How does the brain work like a travel agent? The first two questions a travel agent asks, where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? And a goal is like MapQuest. You program in where you want to go, make a map, and determine the time. Now, a caveat is to know and let me say it in this way. To know what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know exactly what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Whatever you resist, you draw toward you. Resistance is an engagement. It's just like saying anger is as passionate an attachment as love. Both love and anger are powerful attachments. Here's an example of this principle. Paul Conrad, political cartoonist, said of Charles Coughlin, a 1940s radio preacher, "I knew that anybody who had to holler that loud couldn't be right." And most suffering is the result of resisting what already is. People resist going to the doctor, but they aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial will be confronted. 4, you're writing your own story. Do you have specific, measurable goals? Now, this seems awfully simple for us as coaches, but in a Harvard study began in the mid-1950s, 10 to 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates fashioned a vision and specific goals for their life and business. 5 decades later, those 10 to 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. And there was a similar, more recent longitudinal study of Dartmouth graduates. And 7% had goals, specific life and business goals. They ended up with 90% of the assets of the entire group. Motivation increases as soon as you're clear about the goal and the payoff. Focus enhances when you have a specific plan and strategy. Now, I would suggest to review from the workbook, especially the exercise 11 Steps to Ignite Success, and especially focus on the SMART goals and key initiatives and next best action. That is often quite useful for a client to help them develop those and to look at the client establishing SMART goals and a time frame, and then 3 initiatives for each SMART goal, time frame for that, and then 1 next best action for each initiative. It's a way to ladder the process of stepwise movement toward goal. It's estimated that less than 10% of people have measurable goals. 100% of people have good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal, measurement and time, where and when, the travel agent questions. So here's a good idea. I'd like to lose weight. Here's a goal. I will reach 185 pounds by 5 p.m. February 28th in the year 2015. Good idea. I want to make more money. A goal. I will generate $220,000 from coaching and $215,000 from products and royalties in the next 11 months. Here's a good idea. I will save more for retirement. Here's a goal. I will set up an automatic deduction of $300 a month from my checking account and a continuity program to automatically be deposited in a retirement account. Then, write a breakthrough goal, something that would stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, and move you to a higher level, a quantum leap, getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list, spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs, and every August riding on the coast of Maine. Now, you'll have to substitute your own goals there. Then, reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. 5, you're writing your own story. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. And this is something that we know quite well as coaches, that we focus on a simple, specific action to create a sense of effectiveness and initiate a model of mastery. And here's an example, and I think a couple of you have heard me use this example before. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Since he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed to average 24 miles a day and completed the run in 143 days. Immediately after the race, he was interviewed and asked, with his challenge and having thousands of miles ahead and being exhausted, how did he keep going? His response, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. So divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything seemed curiously out of focus. I met with him each week for about a year. I'd glance at the photograph until finally, toward the end of the year, I finally asked him about it. He said, look carefully, Dave, what do you see? Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed just out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value. I had a particular interest in photography. I'd been published in National Geographic World. But my experience and interest did not help any. I said, Steve, the only thing I noticed is that there's only one branch of one tree in focus in this entire picture. And I thought I was being funny. He said, well, that's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing you can have in focus and see clearly, which is why he was a superb supervisor for first-year residents. 6, you're writing your own story. Be consistent in the pursuit of your goals. It takes 25 to 30 days minimum to etch a new pathway in your brain to make it permanent. Remember the NASA astronauts. So write your new story consistently for it to become the default mode. Malcolm Gladwell reminds us that the difference between a genius idea and a true story of success is about 10,000 hours. 7, you're writing your own story. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't working will become evident and self-perpetuating. Now, that's all really simple. Good parents have known this for centuries, but sometimes it takes human science and cognitive research to remind us of the obvious. So we can foster change by conscious practices and effective tools. An infinite sea of new patterns and possibilities can be created to further new goals. The caveat, you have to take action to diminish pre-programmed responses and to write new script for new experiences. A new story has to replace the old one. There are no shortcuts, since long-term change requires consistent practice, repetition, to grow new neuronal pathways and establish new neural networks. But there are effective and efficient methods to accelerate optimum change and ensure transformation. 8, you're writing your own story. Ask for feedback. To your partner or spouse or colleague, ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate the quality of our relationship. Or to employees or professional colleagues, on a scale of 1 to 10, how am I doing? Then how can I get to 10? A tribe in southern Africa called the Babemba has an interesting practice. When they hear a story of a person doing something wrong, something that destroys the social net of their tight community, all work in the village halts. The people gather around the offender and one by one recite all that person has done right in his life, good deeds, responsible behavior, thoughtful acts. This honest feedback on misbehavior has a time-honored consequence to allow the person to reclaim the better part of himself. He remembers who he is and why he is important to the life of the village. This may have been an original 360-degree feedback. Even without this kind of social network and feedback, we can relax and remember our way back into alignment with our true selves. We can get centered and reconnect with our true essence. So, find people who already successfully do what you want and get what you want. Research what they do in order to do your version of it. Ask, learn, question, but make it your story. And guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart, it's that I stay with problems longer. Was Albert Einstein. An interesting statistic is that after giving a complete presentation about the benefits of their service or product, more than 60% of the time seasoned salespeople didn't ask for the order. So how to ask is a crucial factor. Ask clearly, confidently, sincerely. Virginia Satir, the well-known family therapist, was hired by the Michigan State Department of Social Services to submit a proposal on how to restructure the Department of Social Services to better serve the client population. 60 days later, she provided the department with a 150-page report. They said two things. This is the most amazing report, and how did you come up with all those brilliant ideas? She said, well, I just asked all the social workers in your department what it would take for the system to work better. Now, as a kind of a sidebar here, you may have noticed that each of these AAA principles of change to author a new story begins the same way. You're writing a new story. That's the first four steps of the roadmap. Recognize, observe, assess, and decide. Compressed into the shorthand of awareness and acceptance. The third A, 12 action steps. 9, you're writing your own story. Get success insurance instead of waiting for good luck. Luck is defined as probability taken personally, or my own favorite, narcissism meets chance. Now, there's a review of research on goal setting in the workbook component that helps us understand a couple of essential components, why people give up on goals, and the inverse, how effective goal setting can help ensure long-term achievement. And I've included there six of the most important reasons people give up on goals. And this was some original research by one of the founders of executive coaching, Marshall Goldsmith. And I'm going to let you review that just because of our time. 10, you're writing your own story. Take a chance. You didn't have a New York Times bestseller before you sent your manuscript to an agent. You get it rejected, you still don't. What do you got to lose? What's the problem? You spent your whole life not having a New York Times bestseller. A young chiropractor just out of professional school wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. Well, he was told he'd never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes and talked to 6,500 people. He asked 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours between 7 and 9 in the morning or 5 to 7 in the afternoon? And which newspaper should I advertise in? He added, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? In his first month, he took in $72,500, and in his first year, he netted over $1 million. 11, you're writing your own story. It's never too late to start. Don't let conventional wisdom or limiting assumptions ghostwrite your story. Cliff Dion was a 61-year-old Australian sheep herder. He heard about a cross-country race from Sydney to Melbourne and decided to enter. He showed up in Oshkosh overalls and work boots. The officials looked at him like he was crazy. They said, this is a race of over 800 kilos. The most seasoned runners in the world compete. Do you have any running experience and equipment? He said, yeah, I run after my sheep every day, and I got these boots and this baseball cap. Well, when the race began, the world-class runners took off as they were trained to begin, and Cliff started shuffling along in his boots. You're supposed to run 18 hours and sleep 6. But nobody told Cliff this, and while the other runners were sleeping, he just kept shuffling along. They were all asleep and couldn't tell him he wasn't supposed to keep running. He shuffled along for almost 4 days. He cut 5.5 hours off the world record. We each have beliefs that limit us. Find the story that will improve you and start believing that. If there were no barriers, what would your ideal life be? And finally, 12, you're writing your own story. Everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. For tens of thousands of years before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity in the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then, the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibility. So stories are simply a way that we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. Step 7, program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. Now, the premise of this is what we have talked about before, that the most compelling force of the human psyche is that we return to our identity. In other words, that's the status quo of the way that our minds and brains operate, because our identity is part of the anatomy of our brain, and the pathways and the networks of what we do are all part of that. So, as we help someone navigate change, we have to help them reprogram something as fundamental as their identity in order to make that change permanent. In other words, to help them recognize how the model of who and what they are, the principles that they're operating on, how that can transform as well as their behavior, and to do that consistently throughout the process of the work itself, so they're revising something as fundamental as their identity. Now, in the workbook, you'll see exercises that for some people may be helpful, like the mission statement. In business, a mission statement is an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and its fundamental values. A personal mission statement can clarify and provide meaning to your daily activities, can add focus and commitment to what you're doing. And a mission statement has four elements: ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. And there's a very succinct definition for each of these in the workbook. So one notion would be to create a personal mission statement. What's your life purpose? What were you meant to do? This can be a simple statement that can be the compass. It's an already existing compass, but it can articulate how you can guide your life story to personal fulfillment. I'll share mine. To inspire and guide others to achieve their unique, most empowered life and business stories. Write yours down. Read it every day. Another aspect is to follow success trails. Have you heard some version of the following? I want to change careers, but I'm not sure what I do instead. I'd like to really get in shape, but I don't know where to start. I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not quite sure what it is. Decide how you want to expand, then pick success trails to follow, and you're each doing that right now by participating in this course. Seek out a mentor, books, program, or resources to help you. Watch someone who's doing what you might want to do and ask if you can pick their brain or learn from them to create your own story. When a good buddy of mine, Art Wilson, who I now do What's Next Exec retreats with, heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice and had completed my professional coach training, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. A few years earlier, and he and I had coached our sons, and he was my assistant coach for basketball. He had been a remarkably successful senior executive at IBM. He had been the lead salesperson and team in the country for IBM for like 3 years running, of like over 10,000 people. And he had left IBM in a very early retirement to begin his own corporation. And he told me how he had chosen five very successful people who had done something similar to what he was doing, asked them to lunch or dinner to pick their brains about what he was about to do. He advised me to do the same. It worked for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition pick his brain for substantial picking fees. So, create a support team, an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor coach, join a mastermind group. Now, there are, there's in your outline about the art and science of affirmations, and this is something that is in more detail in a chapter I'm going to say, remember I mentioned as soon as production person has completed my revision of Outsmart Your Brain, I'm going to send you each a copy of that. And there's a chapter on the old art and the new science of visualization. And there's a component in it about affirmations, because visualizations help rewire your brain. Affirmations make a visualization a complete story. It's the story to support your visualization. So that should be ready very shortly, and I'll send you that. And it's just a structured and a systematic way to both create a vision and to create affirmations to support that vision. Because what this does, when you program your system with a visualized goal and have affirmations for that, it creates structural tension in your brain, cognitive dissonance. It's the difference between where you are and where you visualize and affirm. So your brain then strives to end this tension by actualizing the goal. And affirmations provide the story to support the vision. So structural tension, this dissonance, will give you creative ideas to help you see things you haven't seen before, a perceptual shift, and provide motivation to take action. So how long do you do this? Use a visualization and affirmation? Well, until the goal is reached. How many goals should you generate affirmation for? Well, a reasonable amount, maybe three, that you're working on a regular basis. In this way, you create the feeling of internal success, the experience of it. You inhabit the experience. An affirmation will initially make you feel uncomfortable, maybe even a little anxious. With an affirmation that's positive and not yet achieved, you're challenging the core belief of your identity, of who you are. You are each alchemist. Alchemists are people who believe in potential, in transformative power. And remember the most important lesson from everything I've said during our time today. Just keep going to the next telephone pole. So we have just a brief time. What kind of questions or clarification do you have, or what aspect of this would be helpful for us to talk about?
I have some questions. This is Amy.
Yeah.
What you were talking about when you met with your friend and you two kind of picked each other's brains, it sounds like, and then from there you just started a coaching practice from scratch. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around how this would even work. I'm toying with the idea of going ahead with the PhD. It'll make me feel good, and it'll be a good example for my children to see me finish something. But I'm beginning to feel like I would so much rather do executive coaching than be an actual, you know, certified IO. And so how did you just made the decision?
Why don't you do both? I'll answer that question, but why don't you do both? Why not start a coaching practice now?
That's actually what I was kind of toying with when you said that. I got really excited. I mean, how would I even know about doing that? How could I do it?
There are only three things that you need to start a coaching practice. One is a landline telephone, and I would add, ideally, with a headset, a business card, and a story.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Okay.
Now, there are other things you can add, but we didn't actually pick each other's brain. He's picked my brains about various things, but that wasn't one of them. He was picking his brain for me and telling me the results of his picking the brains of various people who had done something that he had done, and he was asking their advice. So he didn't know this or call it this, but he had five mentor coaches who were actually more mentors, because they weren't coaching him, because he was using their experiences to put together what he wanted to do, because they had done something very analogous to what he was doing. And he knew that I was doing something very similar, because I was leaving a whole arena of work and beginning to enter another that had to do with meeting with people and coaching and consulting them. And that's exactly what he did, more consulting and coaching. So he gave me some ideas about what worked and the structure of it, and suggested that I do the same for other people who had different ideas. Now, I think the same, and I do that for people who are beginning a coaching practice, because the composite is what I call mentor coach. It's why I call myself a mentor coach, so that I can help other professionals do exactly that and get a jump start on their practice or do whatever they need to do in the whole arena of executive coaching to play a bigger or better or different game. And, the whole area of executive coaching is not about starting a practice, but what I'm talking about, the examples here, are really about that. So that's exactly what I did, and how the dinner with him was really a great jump start. Now, does that begin to address your questions, or are there more?
It definitely does. I think I need to probably another hour with you to sit down just one-on-one and ask you. So my mind's just reeling right now. I'm going to the Tony Robbins conference this weekend. It's 4 days in Dallas, and the person that I spoke to was an executive coach, and I happened to ask him, I said, oh, so how did you pick out your location for your office? Because I've been kind of toying with this randomly. And he said, oh, I office from home. I've never actually met anyone face-to-face. I do it all on a landline. So right now what you're saying to me is just resonating. I feel like I'm getting hit from all sides, and I'm incredibly excited by that. So
I do exactly the same. I gave up my office because I didn't really use it. And I do everything from my home, and I meet with every client, even people here in Houston, by telephone. The Robbins thing is going to be terrific. I'm a huge fan of his. If there's one person out there who I believe really works at synthesizing and integrating material from various kinds of arenas, including neuroscience and psychology, it's him. And I have listened to everything he's put out. My wife and my two stepdaughters have both been to that 4-day thing that he did. And in fact, the one he did in California when it was televised, and Oprah did the fire walk. My wife did, walked on the fire right after Oprah. So I'm a huge believer in that. I think that's a terrific experience, and I think it will be really a nodal event for you. And I'm glad you're having that. You've had this kind of warm up for that, and I think it'll be a tremendous experience.
And I'm really excited.
It'll be eager to I'll be eager to hear.
Okay, wonderful. And I don't want to take up all this time, so I really do want to pick your brain more. But we'll do it a different.
Okay, since we're out of time today, let's jot it down, and we'll begin right here next time.
Perfect.
Thank you all very much for all of your energy and participation, and I'm really excited about the discourse and the usefulness of our discussion. Hopefully for each of you and for me as well. So thanks very, very much. Have a great rest of the week.
You too.
Thank you, Dave.
Bye now. See you guys.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.